Hey guys, this is Aiden from the Long May She Reign podcast. While I have your ear, let me tell you a bit about my podcast. I created the Long May She Reign podcast to give voices to all the women of history from ancient times to the modern world. And if you like crazy interesting stories and my poor attempts at humor, you would love my podcast. Although, a word of warning, don't start with my first episode. Now back to your regularly scheduled podcasting. Goodbye!
Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Bonjour and bienvenue to Battle Royale, where we are passing judgment on all of the Eleanor of Aquitaine's. From Eleanor of Aquitaine to Eleanor of Aquitaine.
To Eleanor of Aquitaine. Will she be selected as the creme de la creme, or will she be sent to the nosebleed section?
So I think we could pretty much already call it here.
Well, let's pretend
without
that
even
we don't.
Going into it. But we have to go into it because I think this will be a great episode. We're going to delve into a part of her life that's not as often like known about,
covered.
Probably.
Everyone just knows her when, like, after, like, you know, when she was in England, really. And that's mainly because she gave birth to, like, Richard Lionheart,
yeah.
I feel.
But she's most famous as Queen of England, but she's actually the only person ever to have been both Queen of England and Queen of France at different points in her life.
So she's the only one who got divorced and then became a queen for someone else.
Basically, yeah, and it's a very interesting story that we'll get into. So our focus, as I said, it's going to be a bit different. Most people in the English-speaking world know her as the Queen of England and come at her from the angle of English history. But we have spent very little time talking about English history on this podcast.
For obvious reasons.
We feel like a lot of our listeners already know about stuff like the Norman Conquest and the Plantagenets. Apologies if, like, we just breeze past that stuff often.
Yeah.
And, like, don't
even though I do love saying Plantagenets. It's just such a fun word.
Well, there'll be a lot of Plantagenets in this episode, let me tell you.
I just love saying the word.
Because Eleanor gives birth to, like, half of them. But, what was I going to say?
We're looking at the French part.
Obviously, if you want to look at the English part, go listen to Rex Factor, who we're based on, because we consider all of that ground to be ground that's already covered. And they actually, this episode more than ever, because they have an episode on Eleanor of Aquitaine, which is why I was resisting doing this episode in the first place.
And I was like, we must!
Yeah, yeah.
And all the listeners were like, we must!
I don't want us to be seen as like trying to replace their episode.
Yeah, we're just doing a different point of view.
Also, Queen's Podcast, our friends at Queen's Podcast, have a three-parter on Eleanor, which is really good. I've listened to it to revise for this episode, so the occasional Queen's Podcast reference may make it into this episode.
But I'm sure they'll be happy for that shout-out.
Yeah. But yeah, in terms of the rating, we don't really rate people as consorts. We rate women who are regents of France, and we rate special people in whatever... however they held power themselves.
Yeah, and she was a special person.
Yeah, so we're going to be rating Eleanor kind of as Queen of France, kind of as Queen of England, but mostly as Duchess of Aquitaine, which is her actual title that she held in her own right. And I think that's the most fair way of judging her, because that's how she saw herself, I think.
Mm.
So, with that out of the way, let's get into Eleanor.
Yes.
I barely scratched the surface of all of the research and writing that's been done about Eleanor, so...
because there's so much.
If I miss really big things in her life, I can only apologize and refer you to the other podcasts I've mentioned, Rex Factor, Queen's Podcast.
Or if you're wondering why we missed it, it doesn't matter. That means you already know about it.
Exactly.
You know, it's funny. For ages, like, so I've always loved Eleanor of Aquitaine, but for ages I hated the name Eleanor because... when I was in school, there was this girl who, like, bullied me whose name was Eleanor.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so for, like, ages I hated the name Eleanor because I just always associated it with this girl who was really mean to me.
I have not had that experience with the name Eleanor, but... oh, actually, I've always loved the name Charlotte until there was... I got rejected by a girl in high school who was called Charlotte. even though I ended up being gay. You know, it still hurt.
I always liked the name Charlotte in terms of the nickname Lottie. Because I just love
Lottie's
that name,
a great
the
name.
The new nickname.
Yeah.
I know.
But Eleanor, so. Eleanor is like my... If my first child is a girl, she will be called Eleanor.
I like, know. I still remember one of our like first conversations, we were talking about Eleanor and you're like, yeah, if I had a daughter, I'd call Eleanor. And I remember at the time being like, oh, that's hard for me. I just got out of high school.
Yeah. Although if I marry like a Hispanic person or like an Italian person, which is like, you know, the goal, then she would be called Leonor or Eleonora. There's lots of versions. We'll get into the versions of her name. But anyway... yes.
Back on track.
So, Eleanor, let's go back. Let's go into a bit of the history of the Duchy of Aquitaine, which is Eleanor's
yes.
birthplace and the thing that she's going to be ruling for this whole episode.
Yes.
So, Eleanor's house is called the House of Poitou, after the mm-hmm. Poitou region, which is actually located just north of Aquitaine. Aquitaine proper. Aquitaine, not the duchy, which like gets very bloated, like, is located at the mouth of the Garonne River, which flows into the Atlantic Ocean. So it's that southwest part of France. Not all the way south, like border with Spain, but like middle southwest. And the Garonne flows down from the Pyrenees Mountains eventually, but it sort of meanders through Toulouse as well in the southeast. And going north, we get to Poitou, which is between Aquitaine and the Loire River, up towards northwest of France.
Are you sure it doesn't border Spain? Because it looks like that in the pictures.
South of Aquitaine is Gascony, which the Duchy of Aquitaine does rule in Eleanor's period. So Eleanor was also the Duchess of Gascony.
But the actual Aquitaine is
But it's not like
smaller.
Aquitaine proper, you know. And I'll probably be showing you a map at some point when we get to all of what she and her second husband rule.
quite a bit.
Yeah, so Eleanor's house, there was the House of Poitou.
So it just always makes me think plateau when I hear that.
It's kind of the opposite of a plateau. It's a valley.
I know, so it's kind of funny.
Which is interesting. So they were also called the Ranulfids because they were descended from Ranulf I, Count of Poitou, who we actually met in our Robert the Strong episode. So going way back.
That name sounds familiar.
He and Robert the Strong were like besties, sort of allies. Yeah. They fought together. They were fighting together in the battle that Robert Strong died in.
Fighting buddies.
Fighting against the Vikings. So yeah, Ranulf, he got put in charge of Poitiers, which is the capital of Poitou. That's the thing about France. All of its regions have cities that are the capital of the region, but then the region has like a name that's like the same but slightly different. Like Angers, yeah. Anjou, Bourges, Berry.
Makes it easier though to remember though. Completely different.
But it's also kind of hard as well. You've also got Limoges, which is the capital, Limousin. Yeah, it's like...
just slightly different enough that can be annoying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So yeah, that was back in the reign of Charles the Bald, where Ranulf became the first Count of Poitou. And the 9th and 10th centuries were rather chaotic for Aquitaine. The title of Duke was held by Ranulf's either son or grandson, I can't quite remember. But the title of Duke kind of ping-ponged between the houses of Poitou... Auvergne, which is more middle of France, and Rouergue, which is down near Toulouse. So you've got these different houses coming into Aquitaine, you know, fighting.
Mm.
And the duchy was even usurped at one point by our nosebleed section ticket holder, Hugh the Great. But then after Hugh the Great's death, he failed to pass Aquitaine to his son, Hugh Capet.
Yeah.
Although Hugh Capet ended up making an alliance with the House of Poitou by marrying Adelaide of Aquitaine, who is Eleanor's sort of great, great, great aunt or something. So Aquitaine went to Adelaide's father or brother, something, whose name was William. And get used to Williams because they're all going to be called William, all of the Dukes of Aquitaine. So he was called William III or William Towhead. It's either Towhead or Towhead. I don't know how to pronounce that. But it basically means he had white blonde hair. And this is why a lot of people think Eleanor was blonde, because her family had a record of being quite blonde.
Yeah.
But equally, people think she had dark hair because she was from the South. So it's like, nah. Not important, though. But from this point on, we as I said, we get a buttload of Williams all the way down to William the Ninth, who's perhaps the most important person for, like, setting the groundwork for Eleanor, because he was known as William the Troubadour.
Mm.
He went on the First Crusade. He brought back all of this knowledge from all of his travels. He brought back these bards to court who were the troubadours. Yeah, he was just very flamboyant, very, like, womanizing, very flirtatious. And he just basically made the court of Aquitaine into this, like, the place to be. It was like Paris is now, where Paris is, like, the cultural center of the world. That was Bordeaux and Poitiers back in the day. Whereas Paris, we'll get to it, Paris was a bit of a dump in this at this point.
What, backwaters?
Yeah, it was a bit of a backwater. I mean, the kings, the early Capetian kings, as we know, they're known for being very pious and not being very into fancy things.
Yeah.
A bit more down to earth. Whereas the Dukes of Aquitaine, who are at this point becoming the most powerful vassals of the King of France, owning more land than the King of France, we'll get to it. But yes, they are definitely the more culturally influential, I would say.
Trendsetters.
Yeah. So let's get into William the Ninth's very scandalous love life.
Yes.
So among the women that he womanized was a woman named Dangereuse, which is a great name. It just means dangerous. Dangereuse was probably a nickname that she earned because of her dangerousness, which just basically means that she, you know, slept around.
Was fun.
Yes, was fun. So both she and William the Ninth were married. Dangereuse was married to a viscount in his, like, royal domain. Oh, and by the way, Aquitaine has the same problem that Paris has, where, like, all of their little lords in their royal domain are just, like, squabbling and, you know, defying the king slash duke and, like, just being a nuisance. Yeah. And Dangereuse is married to one of these nuisance lords. But, William the Ninth sort of gets her to, you know,
not for long.
Have a bit of fun. So Dangereuse sort of manipulates William the Ninth into getting her daughter, whose name is Aenor, to be married to William the Ninth's son, William the Tenth. It's a very messed up situation.
Yeah.
Where William the Tenth is being basically forced by his dad to marry his, like, dad's mistress's daughter, who's like kind of his stepsister in a way, but not really.
Weird.
It's very messed up.
It always is.
Yes. And these two, William the Tenth and Aenor, become the parents of Eleanor.
Yay.
That makes Eleanor the granddaughter of both Louis the Ninth and Dangereuse, who are sleeping together. But from different, they're not, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like if like her mum's mum and her dad's dad are a couple.
Mm.
Not good. Anyway.
But they don't have any kids together, right? Those, like, grandparents, I guess.
Well, they may have had a son named Raymond, but it's unclear whether Raymond is the child of William the Ninth's actual wife or Dangereuse. It's very unclear.
Let's hope not, because that just makes it so messy.
But Raymond, he doesn't make things messy because he ends up going on crusade to the Holy Land. He ends up marrying the princess of Antioch and becoming the prince of Antioch. Yeah. And but he will come back into Eleanor's story. Yeah.
Okay.
So Eleanor, let's get into her etymology. And by the way, she's born between 1122 and 1124. Her name is a contraction of the Latin alia Aenor, which means the other Aenor. So she's named after her mother. She would have been called Alienor in her time.
And what does Aenor mean?
Aenor means famous wealth in Germanic.
So she's the other famous Will.
Yeah, she's the other famous Will. The more famous, more wealthy one, maybe. However, this etymology is actually disputed because there were other Eleanors who existed before her and don't seem to have been related to the name Einor. We're really not sure.
Yeah.
So there was a Countess of Flanders named Eleanor, who was William the Conqueror's aunt, and she was born over 100 years before Eleanor. So,
yeah.
You know. But regardless, Eleanor of Aquitaine definitely popularized the name. And after her, we're just going to see like a flood of Eleanors across Europe, right up to the modern day, because the current heir to the throne of Spain is an Eleanor.
Mm-hmm.
Leonor, Princess of Asturias. And I told this to Eliza before, but she popped into my head when I was researching Eleanor of Aquitaine, because I was like, oh, another person called Eleanor who, you know, is going to inherit something huge.
It will be queen.
Yeah. I mean, assuming her dad doesn't have a son because they don't have the same thing that England now has where kids succeed regardless of gender. It's a bit stupid. Mm. Apparently the Spanish Parliament's blocking it, but that's a digression. Eleanor was followed by two siblings, a sister named Petronilla and a brother who was, of course, named
William.
But sadly, William died aged 4, leaving Eleanor and Petronilla as the most valuable heiresses in France, perhaps even Europe.
That name, Petronilla,
yeah. Named, of course, after Saint Petronilla, who we talked about in our Christmas episode with Pontifex.
Yay.
Yeah. But yeah, so being these big heiresses put them in a position of obviously huge honour and privilege, but also huge danger. Because remember, we've got all of these little viscounts running around
And they're probably all like, ooh, if we marry her as well.
Yeah. And, of course, William the Ninth had already set a precedent of lower nobles being able to marry into the ducal family.
Yeah.
Like, he's broken that seal by getting Einor married to William. Potentially, this means any of the surrounding vassals could rise up, claim the duchy, forcibly marry one of these daughters to them.
Yeah, not good.
Meanwhile, more bad news. Eleanor's mother, Einor, died in 1130 when she was about 7 years old. Her mother was largely absent from court throughout her childhood. So she probably didn't feel the loss all too much. Her parents just didn't get along because of, you know, they kind of resented the fact that they'd been forced to get married. I am wondering if Dangereuse was potentially a mentor to Eleanor in early days, because Dangereuse lives another 20 years. So she's quite old by the time she dies, but it's unclear how much contact she had with Eleanor now.
Yeah.
So getting into Eleanor's childhood, despite the tragedy and danger that surrounded her, she showed early signs of being an extraordinary person, a worthy successor of her father and grandfather, who were known for having boundless energy, artistic ability, and magnetic personalities. So
she would have had access to like the best education of the time.
Oh yeah, too. And she would have spoken like 5 languages. Like, she was fluent not just in, like, the court French that the royal court would have had, but she was also fluent
English.
Maybe not English. She probably didn't speak English, Latin. Actually. Definitely Latin. The local dialect in Poitou was called Poitouvin, and she would have spoken that. And she also would have spoken the more southern language of Occitan, or the Languedoc, as it's also called, which basically means the language where they say oc to mean yes rather than oui. Which is the Languedoc, which is court French. That's a little linguistics lesson there.
To know that.
So yeah, Eleanor is described by chroniclers as not conventionally attractive, because chroniclers always have to mention how attractive a woman is. But, you know, she had like a special something about her.
Obviously.
Kind of reminds me of like Cleopatra, how like she wasn't meant to be like stunningly beautiful, but she had like a way about her.
The charisma.
She had the swagger. And as we said, her appearance is of much dispute. None of the contemporaries say what she looked like in terms of like eye color, hair color, that sort of thing. So historians have just like made stuff up since then by saying like either she was very fair, blonde hair, blue eyes, or she had like dark features because she was like a bit of a dark horse. you know, it runs the gamut.
Who but knows?
I think she was more likely to have been fair because her ancestry was very Germanic. But I do agree that she definitely gives brunette energy.
Yeah.
With how she lives her life. Or maybe redhead energy. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. I do love a good bit of redhead.
We'll be right back after this.
The commander said, "Don't worry, I don't have the authority to kill you today," which was positive for that day anyway.
In 1993, Chris Moon was captured by the Khmer Rouge while clearing landmines in Cambodia. With survival probability low, Chris was brought in front of the boss.
He was just given a local nickname, Mr. Clever.
Hi, I'm Steve Windus, host of the Batting the Breeze podcast. I'd love you to check out how Chris survived, along with some other great human stories at battingthebreeze.com. Hopefully see you there.
Energy.
Yeah.
I could have been a redhead.
Well, you got to be team brunette, Eliza. You got to back yourself as a brunette.
I know, but my dad was redhead, so I could have been redhead. I wasn't.
And I'm not just saying she's blonde because I'm blonde and I want to be like her. Not at all. So
I'll take brunette though.
Yeah. So we do know that Eleanor was probably very tall and probably quite athletic in youth, given the amount of riding and dancing she seems to have done.
Yeah, I learned that from the book I read when I was a kid.
Yes.
The Royal Diaries.
Yes. And Eleanor's father, William the X, who actually becomes a saint, is portrayed as the ideal warlord for the age of chivalry. He's strong yet sensitive. After her mother's death, he took a long time to get around to getting married again. He was just about to take on a new wife when he decided...
go on the Crusades.
Well, he'd done various little war crimes that we won't get into, and he felt bad about them. So he
decided to become holy.
No, he decided to go on pilgrimage, which is not quite the same.
Yeah, that's holier.
Yeah. So it's like a non-violent crusade, basically. And he goes, instead of going east to the Holy Land, he goes west to Santiago de Compostela in northwestern Spain, which is still a very popular pilgrimage site today among Catholics.
Nice and close too.
Closer
than going to like Jerusalem.
Look, Spain is close to Aquitaine, but this is like all the way along the north coast of Spain. Like, and yeah, he has to walk the whole way. It's quite far.
Still closer than trying to get to like Jerusalem.
Agreed. It's still closer than trying to get to Jerusalem, but it's far enough for William to get very sick on the road from,
of course,
contaminated water.
And die.
And die. But before he'd gone on that pilgrimage, he had dropped off Eleanor and Petronilla in the city of Bordeaux, where the Archbishop was a very loyal supporter, because he didn't trust them to stay in Poitou, where no one was protecting them.
Sneaky vassals.
In either while he's dying or before he leaves on pilgrimage, it's not very clear because I've read it either way, he dictated a will that said all of his lands and titles should go to his elder daughter, Eleanor. So not splitting them up, not splitting Aquitaine up, keeping it strong. And that Eleanor should be put under the protection of the ailing King Louis VI of France.
Oh.
His suzerain, I guess that's the opposite of a vassal, is a suzerain, whose right-hand man, Abbot Suger, and his son and heir, Louis VII, came to Aquitaine as his representatives to sort of look after Eleanor. That's the story that Suger tells us anyway. Another theory is that William the X had said nothing about Eleanor getting married to Louis or or older Louis, you know, taking care of Eleanor, and that this was something the French just sort of made up to justify a hostile takeover of Aquitaine. But Louis VII's entrance into Aquitaine with Suger was itself very peaceful and sort of non-confrontational. Apparently the common folk were won over by Louis's humility and piety. As we said last episode, he was raised in the church and had not expected to be the heir to the kingdom of France until his brother Philip fell off his horse and died. And we'll get a bit more into like what that meant next episode.
It meant bloody stop getting on horses.
Definitely. But yeah, Louis was like, he didn't seem bad at first. He was
on a donkey or something. They don't go fast.
Maybe he did ride a donkey. Who knows?
Donkey, I don't know. Are donkeys fast?
No, donkeys are not known for being fast, no. Donkeys are good at a good
probably
for,
like, if someone's on it. Yeah, like if someone's on the donkey.
Donkeys are good if you're like going over mountains because they have very short
Greece.
Footing. Yeah, and they're good for carrying large loads. But in terms of going fast
and carrying Jesus.
Ideal. And carrying Jesus. Well, you know, holy men always ride donkeys because they're more humble.
Yeah, I know. They're so cute too.
Enough about donkeys.
Yeah, sorry.
Not sure how we got into donkeys. Oh, yeah, because they're better than riding horses. Definitely, I would agree that they, because they can't make the same speed as horses, it'd be better if all these princes just rode donkeys.
If you bloody fall off a donkey and die, then your bones are super weak.
But
you landed on a rock.
I honestly wouldn't be surprised if Louis VII had ridden a donkey into Aquitaine because A, he was much more humble and pious, and B, probably traumatized by the death of his brother. So,
stay away from those horses.
So prior to this point, the House of Capet and the House of Poitou had obviously built a strong relationship. They had that marriage alliance back with Hugh Capet. And now they were considered almost distant enough to have another marriage alliance. Which they technically weren't distant enough because Louis and Eleanor were third cousins. And that was technically illegal. Mm. But the church sort of waived it and they were like, it's fine, you guys. It's fine.
They're like, yeah, it's third cousins. It's not first, not second.
When news came to France of William's death in July of, what year is this? of 1137, Eleanor and Louis were immediately married in Bordeaux. And once Eleanor was safely married, they could proceed to her ancestral home of Poitiers without fear of her getting kidnapped and forced to marry someone else. And there they were proclaimed Duke and Duchess of Aquitaine, and they were also crowned as junior king and queen of France.
Mm.
Less than a week later, though, they were no longer considered junior because news arrived from Paris of Louis VI's death.
Damn, just like 1 week.
Yeah,
he held on, though, just for that.
Yeah, Eleanor and Louis, these two teenagers...
Suddenly are the rulers.
Inheriting most of France between themselves at the same time.
Damn.
Yeah, it's crazy. So yeah, Eleanor was brought to the French royal court to be introduced as its new queen. So the royal domain at this time has grown considerably thanks to the incremental expansions of Philip I and Louis VI. So it now comprises the Île-de-France, so area around Paris, as well as the Upper Loire Valley, which is the area around Orléans. The Vexin, of course, the borderland with Normandy. Yeah. Parts of Picardy, up near Flanders. And also the Berry region on the threshold of Aquitaine. So that's the royal domain. It's kind of a sort of like pizza shape at this point in France. Meanwhile, the ducal domain of Aquitaine completely dwarfed the royal domain. It stretched from the border of Burgundy in the east across the Massif Central in the center of France, which is where Auvergne is, all the way to the Atlantic Ocean, and then down to the border with Spain. So that's the entire southwest of France and a big chunk of the middle. Aquitaine's main rival for power was the county of Toulouse, which Eleanor actually had a claim to through her grandmother Philippa, who back in the a century ago, had been passed over for inheritance in favor of a male cousin.
Of course.
So she got Empress Matilda'd, basically. And so now, and so Eleanor will attempt twice in her life to get Toulouse.
Obviously unsuccessful.
So on top of that, Aquitaine was probably the most agriculturally rich and fertile region of France. Got loads of rivers, mild weather, and the volcanic soil of central France. So think of it like the Reach from Game of Thrones. And like, think of the House of Poitou as like House Tyrell in a lot of ways.
Yeah, okay.
They're like the more flamboyant, southern, you know, culturally advanced, rich people. And they come to court and they're like, everyone's fashion is outdated and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So the only thing Aquitaine was really missing was a port on the Mediterranean, which is why getting Toulouse would have been so good, because that's on the, that's nearer to the Mediterranean.
Covering all the bases.
Yeah. So we've got the Duchess of this rich, culturally vibrant, sunny, colourful region. In fact, Eleanor is sometimes called the Summer Queen. And she comes to Paris, which at this point is still just like a soggy, cold little city on an island in the middle of the Seine.
She's probably not impressed.
Not impressed at all. She hates it. The palace is uncomfortable and drafty. The decor is old-fashioned. Mm. The people are too pious and austere. In later life, Louis VI, you know, he was a fun king in life, but in later life he got rather strict and a bit paranoid, and he allowed Abbot Suger to take control of a lot of the stuff at court, which we liked Suger, but definitely having a monk in charge tends to make things a bit more drab.
Damper.
Yeah, damper.
Dampens, puts a damper on it.
Puts a damper on it. Nobody was having fun at this court.
Especially Eleanor.
But luckily, Louis is absolutely smitten with Eleanor in these early days.
Aww.
Albeit in a very childlike way that suggests a rather stunted development.
So it's like puppy love.
It's like puppy love, because he's in love with Eleanor, but he's absolutely terrified of her vagina. Like, he does not want to have sex. He's so been raised as a monk. It's not lost at all. I'm thinking, like, he was either asexual or, like, his upbringing in the church had just conditioned him to hate sex.
Just really put a damper on that.
Like, he'd been growing up and, like, Abbot Suger had, like, pointed to a picture of vagina and
was like, no!
And was like, no, this is the devil.
And do not go near it.
He'd just grown up thinking that.
You will be sucked into the black hole of no return.
But Louis VII in this time received high praise, surprise, surprise, from the church writers. He was very interested in moral righteousness, and he helped increase the church's authority. He's the first king to really support the church reform in a big way, which we'll get more into in his episode. However, Louis's piety was, of course, more of a drawback for Eleanor, because she's come to court. Her one job is to have a son, and it's very difficult. And she has said either at this time or slightly later to have complained, I thought I was to wed a king. Now I find I am to wed a monk.
Honest.
While Eleanor may not have loved or even respected Louis, she definitely knew how to pull his strings in these early days.
Yeah.
He was obviously very romantically and emotionally invested in her.
Yeah.
So he basically gave her whatever she wanted. So Eleanor was like, all right, I'm bringing 50 courtiers to court. I'm bringing my sister with me as well. We're bringing all the tapestries. We're bringing new fashions. We're bringing exotic spices. We're bringing vigorous dancing. We're bringing flirtatious manners. And we're bringing hand washing as well, is something she introduces to the French court.
Yay.
Yeah, it was a bit of a pigsty before this. But in doing so, Eleanor was, of course, ruffling a lot of feathers.
Yeah. Especially those pious nobles.
One person whose feathers were very ruffled was the Queen Dowager, Adelaide of Maurienne, who was still very insistent on being involved in the government because Eleanor was a teenage girl who didn't know what she was doing, and Adelaide was quite competent.
So it was like mother-in-law, daughter-in-law not getting along.
Yeah. Adelaide also got married to the Constable of France as her second marriage. Whose name was Matthew of Montmorency.
Matthew.
Yeah. Or Mathieu in French. So she's the second queen, I think, we've seen who gets married again.
To get married after
the husband. King. But it's unlike Anne of Kiev, who'd had to, like, leave court and be banished.
Yeah.
Adelaide
it was more acceptable.
Well, Adelaide just has, like, as much as Eleanor does, she has Louis wrapped around a little finger. But yeah, she's not happy that Louis is now transferring some of that control over to Eleanor. Yeah.
It's like, you're taking my son away from me.
It's very, like, Oedipal complex dynamics here. And, of course, Adelaide probably resented the fact that Eleanor got all of this control and, like, got all this influence, because Adelaide was also a southern princess. She was from Savoy.
But she didn't have that
she didn't get to do that. She came to a court that was already established. King Louis VI was a lot older than her. Yeah. And she hadn't been able to bring anything to court. Like, she'd had to just assimilate and blend in.
Yeah.
And she did very well.
See someone doing something that she couldn't do.
Exactly.
Would be upsetting for her.
So yeah, she was resentful.
Jealous.
Of that. But she wasn't the only person who was resenting Eleanor. The bad feeling was strong against Eleanor when she was Queen of France. And it wasn't just due to cultural differences. Eleanor also made a number of political blunders in her early years.
Oh.
Which, you know, she's a teenage girl. Like, you expect her to make mistakes.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But in this ruthless world where she's not having a son, you know.
You nitpick at everything.
She can only make so many mistakes before everyone just hates her.
Yeah.
So she picked fights with the nobility, particularly that family that's so easy for everyone to fight with, the House of Blois.
They're just the go-tos.
Yes. They are still headed by Tybalt the Great from last episode, who had reunited the Champagne and Blois. So he's like ruling the territory that surrounds Paris, basically. And Eleanor is also getting Louis to fix a lot of her problems in Aquitaine. In 1138, there's a revolt from her pesky nobles in Poitou. And Louis agrees to bring the full force of the French army down on them.
Damn.
But with the exception of Tybalt, who refuses to lend the Blois troops.
Mm.
And then in 1141, at Eleanor's insistence, Louis tried to push his army even further to take Toulouse in her name. But this expedition ended in a stalemate. And this all came to a head when Eleanor inadvertently set off a series of events that would lead to the Second Crusade. How?
What? Yeah, I want to know how she bloody caused that.
She kind of does. Well, you know, she's kind of blamed for the events that end up causing the Crusade. So let's just say she caused the Crusade.
I want to know what she did.
As I said, Eleanor had brought her little sister Petronilla to Paris with her.
Mm-hmm.
Petronilla would have been about 13 when she arrived at court, but this did not stop the king's 40-year-old cousin, Count Ralph of Vermandois, from falling in love with her and attempting to wed her. Apparently, Petronilla was in love with Ralph. It was mutual. And Petronilla petitioned Eleanor to support the marriage. And Eleanor, you know, loved her sister, wanted her sister to make her own choices. Like,
yeah, sure.
So she was supportive. Yes.
Mm.
So she therefore gets blamed for the civil war that this causes.
Oh, that caused a civil war. Damn.
Because Ralph is already married to the sister of Tybalt the Great.
Oh! God, no!
So, Louis VII, of course, Eleanor's got him wrapped around her little finger, so he sides with Ralph, his cousin, in the conflict. So it's the Capetians / Aquitaine versus Blois Champagne.
Oh.
And this conflict rages for about 2 years. Pope Innocent II gets involved and actually sides with the Blois in the conflict, because he was also in a dispute with King Louis over who should be the Archbishop of Bourges, which doesn't help. As the war rages in eastern France, in northwestern France, the great civil war known as the English Anarchy is playing out. Yes. So taking a sidebar to do that for a moment.
Civil war everywhere.
Civil war everywhere. But I guess it's good for France because they can have their own civil war while England's having their civil war.
England's not going to take advantage of it.
Exactly. Of course, this the English Anarchy is between Stephen of Blois, who is now King of England and Duke of Normandy. So he's the brother of Tybalt the Great. And their cousin Matilda, Empress Matilda, who is the daughter of Henry I of England, widow of Holy Roman Emperor Henry V, and now wife of Geoffrey Plantagenet, Duke of Anjou, or Count of Anjou, sorry. So briefest of summaries, as the English Anarchy has been covered on countless other podcasts, and we've gone through it a few times. So Henry had died in 1136, a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Stephen had basically gotten to London first to be crowned King of England.
Yeah.
He had also had a lot of land and influence in Normandy. And he's also married to Matilda, the Countess of Boulogne, who's from a powerful Flemish crusading family. So two Matildas in the story who are enemies. Not confusing at all. So Empress Matilda managed to get to England, but it was too late. And too late. After briefly being declared king in 1141, she was forced to withdraw. But things go better for Matilda's faction across the channel. Geoffrey managed to conquer Normandy in 1144. Geoffrey and Plantagenet.
Yeah.
And this meant that Stephen now just had England. And this is about where we are in the narrative. But just know that the anarchy will continue to rage for another 9 years before Stephen, who loses his son and heir Eustace during the conflict, is forced to name Geoffrey and Matilda's son Henry, Henry II of England, as his heir, and then dies. Yeah. But that's in the future.
It's almost like made that war pointless, like the anarchy.
I know.
You know.
It's so stupid, and like it's an awful time for England. It's called the anarchy for a reason. Mm. Nobody knows who's in charge. There's all of these robber barons running around, killing everyone.
It's kind of like how Elizabeth I didn't want to make like Mary Queen of Scots the heir, but then after Mary Queen of Scots died, her son became king of England.
If you've ever have you read Pills of the Earth by Ken Follett?
No.
Or seen the TV series?
No.
It's basically, it's about these people in England trying to build a cathedral, but they're doing it during the anarchy.
Oh, bad time.
Bad time. So it's just an absolute slog, and like there's so much drama happening, and it's a really good book, actually. I'd recommend the book more than the TV series. It's a long book.
Yeah, always.
But yeah, so that's the anarchy. Back to King of France's civil war with Blois.
Yeah.
In 1144, we're 2 years into the war, and Louis VII is victorious over Tybalt the Great.
Ooh.
Only he kind of has to, because the Pope intervenes and is like, meh, he has to kind of give back the land that he took. But for now, Louis's troops occupy and ravage Champagne.
Oh.
In particular, raising the town of Vitry-le-François under his watch. And this is an event that greatly troubles the young king. All of the town's civilians had hidden in a church and claimed sanctuary.
Oh.
Yeah. And either under Louis VII's orders in a weird behavior shift.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
Or because he had lost control of his troops. I've read it both ways. The church gets torched and the entrances are sealed off.
Burned alive.
Yes. And around 1,500 innocent men, women, and children perish.
In a church. Yeah, that really give you some guilt.
Yes. So Louis VII, who has been raised in the church, is very traumatized by this. And basically there are these three priests in his life join forces to take advantage of the vulnerable young king.
His guilt.
So there's a fiery preacher named Bernard of Clairvaux. There's Suger, the abbot of Saint-Denis. And there's also the Pope himself. And a new Pope takes over around this time called Pope Eugene III. And they combine forces to convince Louis and Tybalt to make peace and to convince Louis to start the Second Crusade. And all of this was because Eleanor just wanted her sister to marry the guy
she wanted
to marry.
Well, potentially wanted to marry.
Potentially.
That age difference.
It's all blamed on Eleanor, of course, because she's the woman. Another woman who we could consider starting this crusade was Melisande, who was Queen of Jerusalem.
Okay.
Because she'd been very freaked out when the Seljuk Turks took the northeastern city of Edessa. Which basically controls the route from Mesopotamia, which is controlled by the Muslim Caliphate, to the Holy Land, which is controlled by the Crusader states who are victorious in the First Crusade. So Edessa has fallen. It's a really good stronghold for the Crusaders.
Yeah. And
Melisande freaks out.
Like, we need that back.
She sends a bunch of letters to the Pope to be like, SOS, help.
So what crusade did Richard Lionheart go on? The third?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, he's not born yet.
yeah, I know that. But I mean, I don't know how long a crusade goes for.
He's not even a twinkle in the milkman's eye yet. But we will definitely get to Third Crusade in extraordinary depth because of a certain king who may join Richard on that crusade. But for now, it's Christmas Day 1145. And desperate to atone for his sins, Louis VII declares before his whole kingdom his intention to mount a crusade to the Holy Land, having, of course, grown up with stories of all the knights of his realm departing on the First Crusade. And this is the very first time that a established European king has gone on crusade. Because the First Crusade, it was
so
all...
he went on it.
Yeah. Because the First Crusade, it was all nobles.
Like he actually left France.
Yes, he actually leaves France.
Damn.
So the cry of Deus vult, God wills it, that always comes with the declaration of a crusade, was taken up most fervently by Bernard of Clairvaux, who is of course a saint, although he's not the Saint Bernard that the dog is named after. He's like a highly influential monk of the newly emerging Cistercian order, or white monks, which is an order that Louis VII strongly sponsors and supports. Yeah. To the extent that he's actually, well, we'll get to it, but Louis VII is actually not buried in Saint-Denis. He's buried in a minor Cistercian abbey. So Suger, I don't know how Suger would have felt about that, but Suger was dead at that point, so he didn't get a say.
Who's the new chronicler then?
There's a bunch of different chroniclers. There's actually, we actually get a chronicler just for the Second Crusade. We get a few, but the one that's traveling with Louis is Odo of Deuil, who is Suger's protege and will eventually succeed him.
Sounds like someone going Deuil.
Deuil. It's D. I actually don't know how to pronounce this. It's D-E-U-I-L. Deuil.
It just sounds like someone's doing like, Deuil, do you understand that?
Deuil. Ooh. Odo of Deuil. Anyway, we're going to call him Odo of Deuil from now on.
But we got to do that emphasis. Be like, Deuil.
Yes. But before we leave on crusade, what's going to happen with Eleanor?
Has she had a baby yet?
Well, she's actually preggers. She got pregnant. She got pregnant shortly before.
While he was feeling guilty, or right before he felt guilty.
It's unclear. Maybe it's slightly before he felt guilty. It was around the
time. Oh my god! And then he also feels guilty, probably because of that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Louis just a weirdo because he insists that him sleeping with his wife is a sin, and we're not sure if that's because he was against the marriage and like. Thought it was like consanguinity or whatever because they were cousins.
Yeah.
Or if he was just making stuff up to excuse the fact that he couldn't get it up. But either way, Eleanor finally does get pregnant and this kind of delays the crusade plans a little bit. But this is 7 years into their marriage, by the way.
Oh, okay.
But yes, their first child is born. And it is a girl named Marie.
Well, not for them, but for me, yay.
Yay for the fact that it's a beautiful baby girl and she's healthy and she's happy.
But it's a girl, so they're
but
like,
it's a damn. Girl. So she's gonna ruin everything. So it's obviously not the son Louis wanted, but it proved that he could have children.
Yeah.
And the fact that
means it was Eleanor's fault or something for it being a girl.
Oh, it's all, of course it's Eleanor's fault. Everything's Eleanor's fault.
Anytime a woman gives birth to a girl, like in royalty, it's the woman's fault for it being a girl. It's like, so the woman's going to look at their womb and go, I want a girl, give it to me.
So Louis is like torn between like working up the courage to having another child and going on this crusade. And meanwhile, everyone at the French court is like, don't leave us with Eleanor as the regent. So the solution is to bring Eleanor on the crusade.
Oh, heavily pregnant.
No, she's given birth at this point.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she's just given birth.
Right.
She gives birth, she's she's like heavily pregnant around the time the crusade is declared, and then being she gives organized. Birth before they leave. Yeah.
Does she leave the baby?
Yeah, leaves the baby. We'll get into it. Eleanor isn't exactly like raising her children.
A motherly?
No, she's not very maternal. She's more of a career.
Yeah, she really doesn't have that maternal.
Yeah. She likes to party and she likes to work, but she doesn't like to raise children.
God, she probably hated being pregnant.
Oh, absolutely. Anyway, but
like she probably loved the act that happened for you to have be pregnant, but probably didn't actually.
Well,
like
maybe not with Louis, because he was so
against it. Oh my God. It must have been like, you know, having like just coxing him and coxing like to get into the bed. Yeah. Like, you know.
It's like pulling teeth. Because it wasn't for lack of trying. She was definitely trying.
Yeah. Well, you find out later she's a fertile myrtle.
So how Eleanor felt about this crusade is not recorded, of course, because her opinions don't matter. But it's generally assumed that she was enthusiastic. Apparently she'd been exchanging letters with her uncle Raymond, who was of course the Prince of Antioch, as we mentioned. There's one legend even saying that she and her ladies in waiting showed up dressed as Amazon warriors to depart on the crusade. This is of course it's unfortunately a myth.
That would happen, but let's pretend it did.
More plausibly, she'd of course grown up with all of these troubadour stories sung about the Crusades, and the heroism. So she's like, I want a little piece of that. I want to see the East, you know.
I want to see the world.
I want to go find myself, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And the advantage of this giant army train that she was joining was that she could be kind of with Louis, but also not with Louis at the same time for the whole thing. So, on the 11th of June, 1147, having raised the Oriflamme, mustered thousands of troops, and received the blessing of Pope Eugene in person at the Basilica of Saint-Denis, Louis leaves on the Second Crusade with Eleanor and her ladies in tow, in the baggage wagons. Although Eleanor probably, she's depicted as having ridden, you know, astride horses, so she would have, you know, been up there riding at the front of the army, I bet.
Okay, is it me? You just mentioned like her and horse, but then Louis like on a donkey.
Yes, definitely. Yeah,
she's on like this fierce war horse, and then Louis on this tiny little donkey.
Yeah, so they decided to go over land for this crusade.
Yeah,
which sounds awful.
Yeah, but then again,
water, it's like
drowning.
We'll see it later, sinking. but yeah, Mediterranean has pirates, and also, they had an invitation from the King of Hungary to come stay in at his court. So they left they passed through Metz, and they eventually ended up in Hungary. And in Hungary, they also joined up with King Conrad III of Germany, who is the uncrowned Holy Roman Emperor. He's just King of Germany because of the whole Pope fight thing that's still going on. We have, of course, Odo of Doi there as our eyewitness account, who has lovely descriptions of all of the geography they go through.
Lovely.
Suger, by the way, is left in charge of France. So he is the regent, and he's definitely near death and really struggling.
Yeah. Does he die while they're like?
They're off, but he basically. They get back.
Last breath. And the second they arrive, like, step in French soil, he's like, oh!
He's like, finally I could die.
They step back to French soil and he just senses it in the air and he's like, okay, I'm going now.
Look, he does die at least a year after, but yes, that's the vibe. Yeah. So before he left, Louis had also made overtures to Emperor Manuel I of the Byzantine Empire, who invited them to come party in Constantinople. On their way to the Holy Land. Things went pretty well for the crusading army until they got to modern-day Bulgaria and North Macedonia, where, quote, the strength and morale of the army were put to the test.
Was it Eleanor's fault somehow?
Of course it was Eleanor's fault that these Greek merchants were ripping them off for supplies, and the German soldiers were fighting with the French soldiers, and, you know, people kept plundering the local countryside and but to his credit, Louis VII was very good at punishing when people committed sacrilege against local churches or like hurt local sins. Peasants. He did a lot of mutilations for people who hurt peasants. So that's good. I guess, in a twisted way. And Eleanor was probably quite fed up with this whole crusade thing by the time they got to Constantinople.
Not going the way she expected.
But Constantinople made up for everything. It's, of course, the glittering largest city in continental
it's
Europe.
It's something she's been missing.
It's something she's been missing. The army was made to camp outside for obvious reasons. But Louis VII, rather too trustingly, in the opinion of his advisors, just walked into the city with Eleanor, where the emperor hosted them with great feasts. And Eleanor and her ladies were much admired by the Greeks.
Well, that's good.
They called her Penthesilea, which was the name of the Amazon queen in Greek mythology. So she's like the queen of the warriors, basically, which is very cool.
Oh, cool.
But that's the cool emperor... Title. The emperor, like, he'd given them this feast, and then he's like, all right, can you, like, shuffle along now? Please go. please leave. Yeah, because he was getting very nervous about all of these hungry soldiers outside Constantinople.
So you've seen a done it.
Yeah. All right, you've seen everything. Yeah, bye-bye. I get that. Bye-bye. Conrad of Germany went first. He went ahead through Turkey.
Move along.
And Emperor Manuel deceived Louis and Eleanor into thinking that the Germans had won a great victory against the Turks. And sort of cleared a path for them to get to the Holy Land, when, in fact, the Germans had been well and truly on the struggle bus, and the emperor was just making this up.
So they all come, like, relax, strolling in, and they just see this carnage and mess, and the emperor's just making that up because he wants them to go.
Yeah. So the French army only gets as far as Nicaea when they start seeing all of these straggling German troops, including the king himself, Conrad, coming back from a massacre by the Turkish army
fleeing
at Dorylaeum, which was only a few miles east.
Ooh.
So they're not even like, they're barely out of the Byzantine Empire by this point, but it's already carnage.
Damn.
Yeah.
It's not looking good.
Not looking good. The rugged, semi-arid countryside of Turkey was not what this largely northern European army was used to. So the French and German armies, they relied on their heavy cavalry to do most of their damage, which is great in the rolling hills of Western Europe, but not very useful in the craggy Turkish hills.
Horses aren't used to that.
Horses aren't used to that. Also, heavy armor is probably not very comfortable when it's so hot and dry. It would have been very, very sweaty. Oh, and of course, we've got the constant raids and skirmishes with the Turks, which is not fun either. So Louis and Eleanor finally get to the south coast of Turkey, although they're still nowhere near the Holy Land. They get to the port city of Attalia, and they're just like, right, we've had about enough of this. And they'd been basically like giving each other the silent treatment the whole time. They hadn't been having a good time, by all accounts.
That would test you. Going on a crusade, it tests the relationship.
Because Louis was making all these dumb decisions. One of Eleanor's lords, a guy called Geoffrey, was not obeying orders and screwing things up, which of course was blamed on Eleanor.
Of course.
They'd lost like half their army at this point, and it was all blamed on Eleanor, of course.
Yeah.
It didn't help that her ladies were seen as slowing them down. Because, you know, they had to like stop to eat and stuff like that. You know,
all their stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eleanor's just like, I can't go to the toilet as fast as you. Just stop.
We need tea break.
We need a break.
It's like, we've been walking for 10 hours. And they're like, you can walk an hour more. And she's like, no, we're stopping.
I just had to eat my horse. They literally ate their horses on this.
I don't care.
So, yeah. So they get to Attalia. Louis decides that they should sail the rest of the way to Antioch.
He's like, screw it.
He purchased ships at an extremely high price. We've got, once again, Greek merchants ripping them off.
Of course.
But Louis wasn't able to buy enough to take the entire army. Oh. So he and Eleanor left.
Oh, some had to walk.
Not some, like most. Most of the army had to continue on foot and keep getting massacred by the Turks.
God, they must have hated the king of that.
Probably. And Louis and Eleanor went on ship to Antioch.
Probably like each like staying in their own little quarters of the ship, or one's up on deck, one's below. It's like, nah, get away from me.
If they even were on the same ship. Later, when they leave the Holy Land, they do so on different ships, which we'll get to.
Of course.
So Eleanor would have been thrilled to finally get to Antioch. Her uncle Raymond was, of course, in charge. And they got on like a house on fire. Yeah. They'd never met before. They'd only exchanged letters. Except maybe she knew him when she was like a young child, but she wouldn't have remembered. And the court, of course, reflected the Aquitanian culture that Eleanor had grown up in. So she felt very comfortable and at home in Antioch.
At home. Yeah.
The chronicler William of Tyre describes Raymond as, quote, a lord of noble descent, of tall and elegant figure, the handsomest of the princes of the earth, a man of charming affability and conversation, open-handed and magnificent beyond measure.
Damn, glowing.
He's basically boy Eleanor. He's like the male version of Eleanor. So this was like an oasis for Eleanor in the desert, who basically turned to Louis and said, like, you can like keep crusading. I'll just like stay here with Raymond because we get on so well.
And also, I don't want to be with you.
Yes.
I'll be around
We'll get to that. We'll get to that part. But Louis was stressing the hell out because no sooner had they gotten to Antioch that they had learned that the Turks had completely razed the city of Edessa, which had been their objective to recapture.
Oh, so it's like, oh, we can't recapture that now.
They have to re-strategize. So Raymond comes to Louis and he's like, look, I've got a good idea. You guys just stay here in Antioch. We'll keep you supplied. We'll keep you all fed and defend us because, like, there's this very scary Turkish leader called Nur ad-Din who's just razed Edessa. And he's going to do the same thing to Antioch. So you guys chill here with us. We'll keep having parties. It'll be fine.
Protect us.
And Eleanor is also very pro this plan. But Louis wasn't going to take orders from this guy because there were certain rumors circling around that Raymond and Eleanor were sleeping together.
Yes.
Plus, he wanted to go to Jerusalem to pray, damn it. He'd come this far. He's
like, that's why I started this crusade.
I want to see Jerusalem. So.
God suit.
But yeah, Louis VII is like, Eleanor, we're leaving. And Eleanor's like, no, I'm staying. And so Louis VII gets Eleanor forcibly removed from Antioch, kicking and screaming, and she will never see her beloved Uncle Raymond again, for reasons that we will see. So, to add to the heartbreak of having to leave Antioch and slum it with Louis as he made the laborious trip down to Jerusalem, not even for a strategic purpose, just because he wanted to see Jerusalem, and this is a problem throughout the crusade, Louis makes decisions based on where he wants to make a pilgrimage to, rather than where is the strategic place for his army to be. And it's around this time that Eleanor starts to do something unprecedented for any queen in history. She asks her husband for a divorce.
Oh.
This is when that starts happening. And she won't shut up.
What year is this?
This is 1148. She's in her late 20s, mid to late 20s.
Oh, okay.
And they have one daughter who's at home. Meanwhile, Louis and the German king Conrad make the biggest blunder of the whole campaign, because rather than doing what they'd come here to do and defend Antioch, they decided to attack Damascus, which is sort of near the border of Syria and what's now Iraq. It was definitely like a holy city rich in trade, known for its brilliant metalwork and silkwork and that sort of thing. But it was strategically irrelevant in the war. In fact, it made things worse because the Kingdom of Jerusalem had just signed a truce with Muslim Damascus. So they were just killing this city because it was Muslim without regard to the agreements that had been made by the crusaders who were already here. So they didn't even win this siege. They were defeated in 1148 when an army sallied forth from Damascus and they were forced to retreat. Now very much starving, very much depleted, just with life sucking generally.
And still not reached Jerusalem?
They reached Jerusalem. They go to Jerusalem first, then they go to Damascus, and then they kind come back to Jerusalem with that.
Well, at least they did one step better than Richard of actually getting to Jerusalem.
Yeah, well, it helps that Jerusalem is controlled by the Christians at this point. They're more sort of defending it. But spoiler alert, because this crusade goes so badly, Jerusalem won't be in Christian hands for very much longer.
Yeah.
But at this point, the German king, Conrad III, quits the crusade and returns to Germany because everyone's dead. And Louis VII...
the whole army's like, why?
Louis VII was probably breathing a bit of a sigh of relief because coordinating his forces with the German ones had been a nightmare.
Disaster.
But this left his army very vulnerable and weak. He was forced to go into horrible debt getting them resupplied. And in 1149, he was forced finally to face the music when a message came from France, from Suja, basically saying, help, help, everything's on fire. Please come home now. So yeah, Suja is not, he's a very good administrator, but he's not the best leader. And he was really struggling with all of these unruly nobles in France.
He's like better advisor than leader.
Exactly. Kind of he needed the king's authority to wield power.
Yeah, but he didn't want to be the one in power because everyone complains to him.
So Louis and Eleanor decided to sail home. And by this time, their relationship is non-existent. Separate ships.
I thought they had two kids together.
We'll get to that. They've only had one so far. It's a long story. Okay. So on their way home, they stopped in Italy, where they were hosted and resupplied by King Roger II of Sicily.
That's such an un-Italian name, Roger.
Well, he's actually a Norman.
Oh, that explains.
Because there wasn't just a Norman conquest of England, there was also a Norman conquest of Sicily, randomly. Yeah. For many reasons that we don't have time to get into. But the Norman court in Sicily is its own fascinating thing. The Normans here were very into having a multicultural, multiple language, you know, vibrant trade society, because they're right in the middle of the Mediterranean and there's all these cultures converging. Yeah. So we've got like the local Sicilian culture, we've got Greek influences, we've got Arab influences, and they're all coming together.
Yeah. Mixing pot.
So it would have been a pretty interesting place for Eleanor to visit. However, whatever joy that this fascinating new place might have inspired,
Louis took it away.
Would have been completely ruined, not even by Louis. News arrived from the Holy Land that her beloved uncle Raymond had been captured at the Battle of Inab against the Turkish leader Nur ad-Din, who he had warned them about. And one of the generals had him beheaded. And his head was sent to the caliph in Baghdad in a silver box.
Oh.
Yeah.
Why to Baghdad?
Baghdad is where the caliphate is based at this point. So like Mecca is the holy city that everyone goes on pilgrimage to, but the actual caliph is based in Baghdad at this point.
Okay.
It's a long story that we don't have time to get into. But Eleanor was probably very keen to just get back to France, forget any of this ever happened.
Yeah.
And then there she could properly file for divorce.
Yeah.
Leave Louis forever, go back to Aquitaine where she belonged.
Yeah.
But Louis made one last effort to rescue their marriage.
Oh.
He himself probably didn't love Eleanor at this point.
Yeah.
By this point, he was pretty sure that she'd like betrayed him and made the crusade a lot worse.
But
he was maintaining their marriage because A, she's the Duchess of Aquitaine. That's kind of an important territory. And B, he had made a religious vow.
Yeah, can't go breaking that.
So he dragged her to Pope Eugene III. He brought her all the way to Rome on the way home, rather than going straight back to France. Rome, the Pope has actually been kicked out of Rome.
Again.
Because the people have revolted again. So he's like a bloody yearly town of
yearly occurrence.
It really is.
Like literally it's like, okay, it's on this particular day of every year, let's kick the Pope out. Okay, let's go.
Luckily the Pope had a lovely resort in Tusculum, which he basically just like decked out as a kind of couple's retreat for Eleanor and
trying
Louis
to bring
to go
the romance.
Refer their marriage. Well, so he basically sat them down in a bed and then he was like, now have sex.
Threw some rose petals on them though, but then was like, have sex.
Yes.
I'm watching.
That's exactly what they said on Queen's podcast. They were like, he laid out this honeymoon suite.
Oh no, I'm imagining like this kind of like a case, like just a normal guest room, but then he's just holding this bunch of flower, like petals that are in his robe so you can't see them. So when he goes like, have sex, he just throws out his rose like that and come out of his sleeve. And that's his idea of romance, is just throwing some rose petals out of, like, from under his sleeves.
Okay, whatever the Pope did, he did something, because Eleanor's pregnant again.
Maybe put some aphrodisiac in those petals.
Yes, and her belly is well and truly swollen by the time they finally get back to frickin' France, so that Suja can finally go and die. And guess what Eleanor gave birth to?
A girl.
A demon. No, a girl.
A holy demon.
I wouldn't be surprised if she gave birth to a demon, to be honest. She's so mad. So Suje's dead. Eleanor's given birth to a girl again. Louis's a bit depressed. Because A, he wanted a boy. And B, he loved Suje because he was like his mentor. So Louis just wants it all to be over.
Yeah.
And he's finally just like, fine.
I've had enough.
Eleanor, I've had enough.
You win.
You can go. So on the 21st of March, 1152, we have the Council of Beaugency, where at the Royal Palace of Beaugency, Eleanor and Louis's marriage is annulled by a church council on the grounds of consanguinity. Because they are cousins.
It's always that one. It's the go-to.
It's always that. It's actually really interesting because there's like proper like divorce proceedings where like both sides are on board. And Louis is represented. Louis's like lawyer basically is the Archbishop of Sens, and Eleanor's lawyer is the Archbishop of Reims. And of course, they're going to have a little bishop battle because yes. There's any excuse for Sens and Reims to have a bishop battle.
Yes.
One of the good things from this council is they agreed that their two daughters, Marie and Alix, would remain legitimate.
Oh, good.
They wouldn't be considered bastards.
That's good.
Yeah.
So many times. Yeah.
And this is the point where Louis and Eleanor's paths diverge. Mm. So up to this point, I've been covering Louis and Eleanor pretty equally in the history. So we won't go over all of this again in the same detail next episode with Louis, because there's a lot else to get into with his life. Spoiler alert, he lives a long time after this. But so does Eleanor. So let's get into what Eleanor does.
Yeah, I wonder how she met Henry, you know.
Well, she didn't meet Henry at first. Around the time that the divorce proceedings were happening, she met his father, whose name was Geoffrey Plantagenet. He was quite handsome, and he was quite charismatic.
You're good looking. I bet you your son is.
I hope the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. Henry himself, by the way, is about 19 at this point. He's quite young. Whereas
and
Eleanor
she's, what,
is in her late 30s? 20s.
Or late
20s. Late 20s. Yeah. So after her divorce, Eleanor has a treacherous journey back to Aquitaine.
Oh my god, so she's like the cougar.
She's the cougar, but she is
a good cougar.
She probably would have liked to have a pet cougar or something because she was very vulnerable. There were two different people trying to kidnap her as she moved back to Aquitaine. Henry Plantagenet's brother, Geoffrey of Anjou, Geoffrey Jr., was trying to kidnap her and marry her. JJ. He was 15 at this point. Like, he was trying to kidnap this woman. But there was also a bigger threat was Hugh de Lusignan, who was one of these pesky viscounts in the Aquitaine domains, who tried to trap her when she entered Poitou. But she managed to evade both kidnappers. And she made it back to her court. And then about 2 months after her divorce, on the 18th of May, I've written the 18th of Mary, the 18th of May, 1152, Eleanor secretly marries Henry Plantagenet, Count of Anjou and Maine, Duke of Normandy, and now, shortly will be, the heir to England. Because this is around the time that the English anarchy is wrapping up. He's also called Henry Fitz-Empress to acknowledge his mother, Matilda, which is quite cool. He goes by many names. We're just going to call him Henry II, because he's Henry II of England, basically from this point. Or like 2 years after he gets married to Eleanor. Stephen dies, and he becomes Henry II. Geoffrey Plantagenet, by the way, also dies around this time. So Henry's inherited all that stuff. And by marrying Eleanor, of course, Henry Plantagenet becomes the ruler of, to borrow a phrase from Rex Factor, the left of France. With the exception of Brittany, although even Brittany will end up being ruled by one of Henry and Eleanor's lesser known sons, also named Geoffrey, who actually manages to force the Duchess of Brittany to marry him. So yeah, not very nice. So this territory is usually called the Angevin Empire. Although it's not really an empire, it is a group of duchies within the Kingdom of France that technically owe homage to the Kingdom of France, but, you know, we've been through that before. they're also King of England's territory.
Yeah.
As empires go, it's a very awkward one, not just because of the being in France thing, but also because of the fact that these are all duchies that don't necessarily get along. They're very hard to unify. And it's particularly awkward between Eleanor and Henry, eventually, because they do get along at first.
Yeah.
But, like, once Eleanor has had all of her babies, because, by the way, she's having a lot of babies, which must have really pissed off Louis VII.
Yeah.
She becomes the fertilest of Myrtles at this time, because she and Henry are doing a lot of business.
Getting down. So did they love each other? Like each other?
Well, it was definitely a marriage of convenience.
Yeah.
The convenience being Eleanor gets to pick who she marries rather than getting kidnapped by someone.
They must have some degree of affection to have so many kids.
Yeah, well, they were definitely physically attracted to each other.
Yeah.
But they both had very like fiery temperaments.
So clashing of personalities.
Clashing a bit, yeah. As Queen of England, Eleanor signed her letters by the wrath of God, Queen of England. So she's really, you know, coming into her girl boss phase.
Yes.
And her time as consort definitely reflects this sentiment.
Mm.
So Eleanor and Henry, clearly very attracted to each other, clearly maybe in love, not sure.
Yeah.
But while Eleanor had found Louis VII to be too weak and pathetic, she now found Henry to be too aggressive and overbearing.
I wonder which one she preferred.
Probably Henry.
Yeah. At least she could have sex.
And at least she was allowed to be in Aquitaine a lot of the time and actually rule it. But the problem was Henry was too controlling. He wouldn't let Eleanor control the revenues from her lands and vassals.
So she didn't have him wrapped around her fingers like she had with Louis.
No, not at all. So she has to ask him for money whenever she needs to spend things. She has an allowance. And he also didn't leave her in charge with the army, so he'd take the army out of Aquitaine, and she had to ask him to intervene when somebody, revolted or something.
She's like, can I please have my army back?
Yeah. So there was already a bit of a rift growing between the couple by the time the perhaps biggest event of Henry II's life happened, when Thomas Becket, the Archbishop of Canterbury, was murdered in 1170.
Yeah.
And the revolt of his sons and Eleanor, which happens right after this, is considered divine revenge for the murder of Thomas Becket, which is, of course, blamed on Henry for reasons that we will kind of get into next episode, because Louis VII is involved in some ways.
Yeah.
But we can already see that there were reasons for this rift to happen. So in the 1170s, we don't have much time to get into the ins and outs of the endless conflicts between Henry II and his sons. Go listen to Rex Factor, or I'd also recommend Dan Jones's recent book, The Plantagenets, which is very concise and readable. But the upshot is that Eleanor goaded her sons, now teenagers, into rebelling in order to reclaim her own power, as well as stand up for their rights.
So which sons rebelled?
All of them at different points rebel. And we'll get into who her sons are in Vion Throne. Yeah. We'll save that for there. But her favorite son was Richard.
Yeah.
And he was going to be the one to succeed in Aquitaine.
Yeah. Was he the oldest?
No, he Middle? Was not the oldest.
Yeah, I didn't think he was the Middle. Oldest.
We'll get into it. We'll get into it in Vion Throne. But let's just speed through, because we need to finish the biography. Interestingly, all of this chaos and rebellion that was happening, that Eleanor was partly... To blame for in this case, she got an unusual ally to side with her in the conflict.
Louis,
ex-husband Louis. She got him to join the conflict on her side.
If it's against England.
If it's against Henry, it's fair game. Yeah. So
he's like, okay, we'll put aside that we got divorced. Yeah, I'll join.
Also put aside the fact that Eleanor and Henry had tried to invade Toulouse again, and Louis... had defended Toulouse against them. Yeah. That also is a thing that happens at one point. But breezing past that, it's been 20 years. Bygones be bygones. Yeah. They're teaming up now.
Yeah.
Interesting side note is that Louis' family was also one with many brothers and male cousins, but the Capetians seem to have been a lot more cool-headed and cooperative than the Plantagenets, who were unusually at each other's throats. for any family in this period, and usually fighty. Mm. They all have this fiery temperament.
Well, both parents have it. They then inherited exactly. It, which means double fire.
Double fire. Not the daughters, though. The daughters seem to have been genuinely quite good. Yeah. So,
well, they were just better at keeping it, like, under control and hiding it.
Yeah. So, yeah, in spite of all the opposition, Henry II is actually able to win the war, which is bad for Eleanor. Mm. Henry's sons, they're inexperienced at war. Louis is not the best at war. Eleanor is not allowed to do war.
Like, he probably didn't, like, give her, like, he probably just gave, like, part help, like, you know, not fully invested.
Yeah, you get the sense that Louis, we'll get into it next episode, but Louis is a very pro-peace king. Basically,
yeah.
Any chance he gets to do a peace treaty, he'll take it. So, yeah. Basically, he drops out of the conflict. Eleanor's sons get defeated. And in 1173, Eleanor gets imprisoned by her husband, Henry II. And she will remain imprisoned for the next 16 years.
God, I hope she was at least allowed to walk around the castle grounds.
Yeah. Also, to make matters worse, at this time, quite a few of her children die during her imprisonment. Yeah, and we'll get to how many of her children predecease her. Particularly her favorite. Well, her eldest son, William, died in infancy, but her second son, Henry the Young King, who is the junior king of Henry II, dies around this time.
Also,
the Count of Brittany, Geoffrey, dies. Favorite Richard does not die yet. Not yet. Because, of course, he has to outlive his father to be king.
True. All right. Cool.
Meanwhile, Henry II is having loads of fun with his mistress, Rosamond Clifford. Who was also considered the source of their rift. And there was actually a legend that Eleanor tried to force Rosamond to kill herself because she's like a villain in some folklore. But we'll get to that in Enchanté. Because there's a lot of paintings of it. But on the 6th of July, 1189, news arrives to Eleanor's castle that Henry II is dead.
Ooh,
after a long reign.
She's like, party! I'm free!
Yes. She's in her 60s at this point. And she's like, she gets the news. She acts sad for like 2 minutes. And she just leaves. She leaves the castle. She goes to Richard.
And then you see her going, yeah!
Basically. Yes. Meanwhile, Richard is the king and he immediately leaves to go crusading on the Third Crusade. Yeah. Eleanor is left in charge of much of the Angevin lands while John is also in charge of the Angevin lands and does not do as well as his mother. I think in Rex Factor they say, John starts Johnning all over the place. And if you want to know why John is bad, listen to Rex Factor, listen to anything else. We won't get into it.
Yeah.
But
Watch Robin Hood. The Disney animation.
Yes. John sucks. He's a lion who doesn't have a mane, basically.
Yeah.
Eleanor, spoiler alert, Richard will die and John will become king. But Eleanor served as the voice of reason in both their reigns. She's no longer this fiery young woman. She's become a figure of stability. Yeah, and a wise advisor.
Oh, so she's kind of like Elizabeth II, like that figure of stability.
Yeah. That you see. Very much like that. And at different times, she ruled Aquitaine, Anjou, Normandy, and England as regent while her sons went off to war with mixed results.
Gallivanting.
Yes. But Eleanor's not in the best headspace. This is where we get some of her lamentations in her letters to the Pope. So she says, pitiful and pitied by no one, why have I come to the ignominy of this detestable old age? Who was the ruler of two kingdoms, mother of two kings? My guts are torn from me. My family is carried off and removed from me. The young King Henry and the Count of Brittany Geoffrey sleep in dust, and their most unhappy mother is compelled to be irremediably tormented by the memory of the dead. Two sons remain in my solace, who today serve to punish me, miserable and condemned. King Richard is held in chains, because, by the way, he's captured on the way home from crusade by Emperor Henry VI of Germany. His brother John depletes his kingdom with the sword and lays it waste with fire. In all things the Lord has turned cruel to me and attacked me with the harshness of his hand. Truly his wrath battles against me. My sons fight amongst themselves. If it is a fight where one is restrained in chains, the other, adding sorrow to sorrow, undertakes to usurp the kingdom of the exile by cruel tyranny. Good Jesus, who will grant that you protect me in hell and hide me until your fury passes, until the arrows which are in me cease, by which my whole spirit is sucked out.
Damn.
So yeah, Eleanor's not having a good time.
Yeah. I wonder if she ever thought about it, or maybe it's because of how I raised them or how I didn't raise them, because she just kind of shuffled them off to the nannies. Maybe if they had a bit more motherly love.
She definitely didn't treat her children equally. She was very open about Richard being her favorite.
Bias. Yeah.
Whereas John,
I wonder why the others would have been a bit salty about her.
Whereas John, we'll get to it, but John was born late after all the others, and he was kind of ignored a lot of the time.
And that was when the Rosamond affair started, didn't it?
Yeah. So, sad news, or maybe happy news, depending on how you look at it. On the 26th of March, 1199, after nearly 10 years of rule over England and the Angevin Empire, much of which was spent either crusading in the Holy Land or imprisoned in the Holy Roman Empire, Richard I gets shot by a French peasant with a crossbow at a minor siege. The wound becomes gangrenous, and Richard dies in Eleanor of Aquitaine's arms.
At least he got to see his mother one last time.
Yeah. Eleanor then spent the remaining 5 years of her life between her first home of Poitiers and her second home of Fontevraud Abbey in Anjou, where she took the vows of a nun. And it was in this abbey that her husband Henry II and son Richard were both buried. So not buried in Westminster Abbey in England, buried in Anjou.
Mm.
And Eleanor herself would join them there after her peaceful death around the age of 80 on the 1st of April, 1204.
Where was Richard buried?
There, Fontevraud.
As well. Oh, I thought you said John. Yeah,
I said, and son Richard.
Oh, I thought you said John.
I think John's buried in Westminster Abbey.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Eleanor, she died in Poitiers, the same place where she had been born. Before she was...
Mm. Full circle.
So according to the records of the nuns with whom she spent her final years at Fontevraud, she, quote, surpassed almost all the queens of the world in beauty, justice, modesty, and elegance. And that is the life of Eleanor of Aquitaine. But we've got more to get into in the rounds. So Enchanté. I've got three 19th century or maybe 20th century images.
Depictions.
So the first one is an anonymous picture. Okay. Eleanor's got very pale skin, black hair and dark eyes. Very colourful clothing. Then we've got second one. Eleanor is a brunette and she's got a goblet and she's like holding a knife at her side and she looks like she's about to get up to some skullduggery. And then the third image, she's a redhead.
Oh, she's glowing.
She's looking very ethereal.
Yeah, she's like got a glow, a halo, like an.
She's got a glow, and she's got the Aquitaine crest on her.
She's got an eagle or bird or something, some sort of bird.
Interestingly, so the lion that you see on the Aquitaine coat of arms, the sort of lion on its side, is the third lion that makes up the English coat of arms. So. The coat of arms of Normandy, which England has, is two lions. And then the third lion is adding Aquitaine to it.
Mm. Oh, so and she also has a dog.
Mm. She's also got a dog. These are three images of Eleanor.
Okay.
I'm leaning towards using the first one as like the episode image.
Really?
Well, it's nice and square. And we need a square one. And it's the most neutral looking one, I think. True. It neither glorifies her nor shows her as evil.
I do like the second one though. I like the idea of like the goblet and the dagger.
Yeah, well that comes from the legend of Rosamond, where she forced Rosamond to choose between killing herself with the dagger or killing herself with the goblet. And she chose the goblet. Neither. No, she chose the goblet and she died.
Oh.
According to this legend, which is not true. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, which is why I'm sort of leaning against the that brunette one, because it's based on a legend that's not true and is a bit misogynistic.
Well, since I didn't know that, and I just looked in terms of, oh, it looks like a badass woman.
Yeah.
That's what I was looking at from.
Yeah.
But I guess, like, the first one is very objectively neutral. I do love, though, she's got so many different depictions of herself.
She's got so many different depictions. This is just a selection. Like, I can't show you all the depictions because it would be another hour of podcasting. Yeah. So those are 19th century images. Then we've got a potential contemporary image of Eleanor. Mm. She is depicted on a Psalter, which is a book of Psalms.
Is this like during her imprisonment or before her death or something?
This is when she's old, yeah.
Yeah.
So she's got white hair.
Got a castle, some turrets in the background.
She looks like she's dressed as some kind of nun. As well, yeah. Which she was at the very end.
Nice little shawly robe thing.
It looks like she's wearing a tie. She's very professional.
Yeah.
And then we've got her effigy next to Henry II's effigy at Fontevraud Abbey, which still some of the paint survives.
Thinking that. I was going, damn, still got some of the colour. Unless someone retouched it up, like, you know, a couple hundred years later.
Yeah, I don't know. But you get a hint at how bright and colourful these would have been back in the day.
They I know, because it's funny. White. It's like, you know, when you think like ancient Greek and you think statues and you just think of it all as white, but it's actually, they were coloured.
They were coloured paint.
You know, I do like the white look.
I do like the white look as well, but it is, things were definitely a bit gaudier back in the day.
Yeah.
And then the third image, we've got a fresco. It's a little hard to tell which one is Eleanor, but it is the figure in the middle, who's like the biggest figure in the picture.
Oh, yeah.
And she's got a big old crown, a chunky crown on her head. And she's riding on a horse with her son, John. And riding in front of them is Henry.
Yeah.
And she's reaching out to almost, it looks like Richard back there is giving her a bird. A falcon to sort of hunt with. And then I think Richard is on the same horse with Geoffrey at the back there. So the whole family's out on a hunting trip or something. And they're a big, happy family. No conflict here at all.
They all get along.
They all get along. And then moving away from depictions, we've got a surviving artifact from the reign, which is a very splendid gold and crystal vase.
Damn, that's nice.
Yeah, it's in the Louvre Museum currently. Eleanor originally gave it to Louis as a wedding gift.
Wow.
Back when they were teenagers.
God, and, so old.
Which Louis then, of course, donated to Saint-Denis.
Yeah. So good it survived.
So good it survived. You can thank the Louvre for preserving it and keeping it.
Yeah.
Because it's a very beautiful vase.
It is.
It looks almost like a lantern.
I know, that's what I thought when I first saw it. I was thinking, oh, it's a lantern.
No, it's a vase, a crystal vase.
Damn, crystal that would have been expensive back then.
Expensive. And all of these images are on our WordPress. So going into other depictions, of course, we've got countless poems, novels, plays, operas from 16th century all the way to the present day, which depict Eleanor. Unfortunately, they often depict... they often center on Fair Rosamond and her conflict with Eleanor.
Of course, they always do that. If it's two women, annoying. It's always focused on that.
Rather than, you know, all of Eleanor's achievements.
Yeah. Even though I never knew anything about Rosamond before this.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, like, I didn't. Literally, all I knew about her was, like, you know, king, being, like, queen, like, you know, being girl boss, like, you know.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Well, that is thanks to her reputation getting revived in the 20th century, when, surprise, surprise, women started being able to write more things.
And they're like, can we not just focus on women on women conflict?
So she's depicted in Elizabeth Chadwick's Summer Queen trilogy, as well as, of course, the Royal Diaries by Christiana Gregory, which is how Eliza knows about Eleanor.
Yeah, I loved reading that series as a kid, especially her one. Oh, I remember reading it.
She's also sometimes featured in modern interpretations of Robin Hood.
Mm.
He pops up. He's supposed to have popped up, according to legend, at the very end of her life.
Oh my God, can you please say the how you always say it of John's voice?
Oh, like when he laughs, he's like, aha, aha.
And then he goes, mummy. Saying that,
mummy. It always Mother always liked him. Richard best. I love King. I love Prince John from Robin Hood. And of course, speaking of John, Eleanor is also a character in Shakespeare's play, King John, which is one of the lesser known Shakespeare plays because it's not very good, but Eleanor's in it. And of course, her most famous depiction in the modern day is by Katharine Hepburn in the 1968 film Lion in Winter, where she played Eleanor opposite Peter O'Toole, who plays Henry II.
It's kind of interesting. Isn't he Aussie, Peter O'Toole?
No, he's British.
Who am I thinking of? I'm thinking of someone else, Audrey Hepburn. That's why. Not Catherine.
But this is Catherine Hepburn. No relation. But
they're just both amazing women.
Lion in Winter depicts her and Henry in later life, and it's based on a play by James
Goldman.
It's
amazing how there hasn't been, like, many, like, modern, like, you know, movies and depictions of her, like in terms of like movies or like film and stuff.
Well, The Lion in Winter was remade as a TV movie in 2003, where Eleanor of Aquitaine was played by Glenn Close.
But and, still, even that, like, come on, when you think about how many things there are of like the Tudors and of like, you know, like Elizabeth the First.
Well, apparently, Starz, which produces all of the Tudor shows that are coming out right now, is thinking of making an Eleanor of Aquitaine series based on Alison Weir's novels.
So it'll be very loosely.
Yeah. I mean, I don't mind Alison Weir. I like her better than Philippa Gregory.
Yeah.
Because Alison Weir is an actual historian as well as being an author.
Even though when they make those, like, star adaptations, it's so
loose. I don't like Starz. I don't trust Starz fully. In art, of course, we've got her being depicted by the Pre-Raphaelites as the villain in the story of Rosamund. But then we get to the modern day and we've got her, there's a tribute to her in a very famous art installation called The Dinner Party by Judy Chicago, which is in Brooklyn Museum, where it's basically a big old dinner table which has a setting for all these different women in history.
That's cool.
Eleanor's is like a fleur-de-lis made with like vegetables, and it's very cool. On like a tapestry sort of tablecloth. Yeah. So yeah, she's definitely seen as part of the sort of pantheon of great female rulers in history.
Yeah, even I've cross-stitched her.
With that said, what would we like to give for Enchanté?
I feel we have to get really high. Like, she's so well known and like iconic.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I know what I'm giving her.
Like, women in history, she's on the top who come up.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, like, 9 or 10.
It's got to be a 10.
Yeah, I agree.
If Charlemagne gets a 10 in Enchanté, Eleanor
gets a 10. Okay, she gets a 10.
She's as well known, if not better known, than Charlemagne.
Yeah, true. She'll get a 10.
And is in way more movies than Charlemagne. So.
I can't think of a single one either.
Even though we still think that she's too overlooked, even with all of that.
Yeah. Or that she's still too much depicted the Rosamund stuff.
Yeah, well, the Rosamund stuff is like, it's not really depicted anymore. People kind of have forgotten about that.
I know. I didn't even know about it.
Yeah, because it was a big thing in European folklore 200 years ago, but nobody talks about it anymore.
Yeah.
Because there's just more interesting things that we know about Eleanor now.
True.
So let's get into the interesting things. Let's get into En Garde.
Yes.
Because she's got a 20 for Enchanté.
Yeah.
En Garde.
Eleanor was definitely a fighter.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the physical sense, but definitely in the political sense. At every step, she was fighting for dominance, playing an active role in things. Even though she was imprisoned for 16 years of her life, like, she was imprisoned for a reason. She was really dangerous.
Yeah.
She did make some political blunders in her youth, which set her back, and I think should cost her a couple points.
Yeah, and also she was a teenager.
But yeah, over time she got more clever. She was able to pull things off more successfully, so that by the end of her life, she's become the mediating figure between Richard and John.
Yeah.
And by the end of her life, she was seen as a source of stability. And she's, of course, the reason that the Angevin Empire even exists, because half of it is hers. And she maintains the borders of Aquitaine and even strengthens them throughout her life.
True.
So that's the briefest summary of En Garde. I won't get into too much more detail because we are very much going over time with this podcast. But... what do we want to give for En Garde? It's pretty much almost as fighty-fighty as you can get.
Yeah, she did go on the Crusades.
She went on the Crusades. Failed Crusade.
Still a Crusade.
The extent to which it failed has been unfairly blamed on her.
It's impressive as a woman, though, that she even was like could go on it. Like, I know it's because she was kind of seen as a threat.
Yeah, but, exactly. Like, you know. What are you thinking? What's, like, ballpark?
8 or 9?
I think I'm leaning towards 8 because...
Yeah, I'm thinking more 8. Like, if only I just...
I'm taking a point away for the failed rebellion with her sons. Yeah, and I'm taking a point away for... Actually, maybe 7. Because I'm taking a point away from for the Second Crusade. And I think I should also take a point away for... the
civil war,
you know, causing civil wars and just wrecking things.
Yeah, not I might being make very 7.
Savvy, but she was young.
Yeah,
so I'm thinking maybe 7.5.
I'm gonna go 7.
Okay, so that's 7 and 7.5. So that's a 14.5 for En Garde. She's scored the best of any of the women that we've rated so far. So that's good. She got half a point more than Fredegund. Which I think is good. Voulez-vous? There's a lot more detail I have in this round. So in her early career as Queen of France, Eleanor did not fare super well with the whole getting along with people thing. She often showed poor judgment and callous disregard for local customs and royal protocol when she was in Paris. And by the time she left, she was hated and slandered as a capricious harlot. But once she got out of there, she was truly able to spread her wings. In Aquitaine, Poitiers, she started something called the Court of Love.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that.
Yeah. This wasn't just a court in the sense of, like, royal court. It was also a court in the sense of, like, a law court, where, according to contemporary author André the Chaplain, Eleanor and the women of her court, including her daughters, her nieces, and her ladies-in-waiting, would sit as a panel of judges and adjudicate the quarrels of lovers.
Oh, I love that. Okay, can I tell you hers a lot? Like, as the judge, I'm like, like, you know, hitting the little mallet.
Yeah.
And being like, order in the court. Okay, so what is going on between you two? You didn't send me flowers.
I'm imagining you could do this like The Voice, where they will turn around if they are emotionally moved by whatever you told them.
It's like, no, like whoever wins is who caused the people to like get emotionally affected and cried the most. Yeah. Like who the tragic story.
Yeah. And when I say lovers, there was a very flexible understanding of love and lovers at the Aquitanian court that Eleanor fostered. The most ideal love was a sort of like pining from afar. André calls it, quote, a certain inborn suffering. That's how he defines love. And it didn't have to be sexual. And also Eleanor was very skeptical of the idea that love could exist in marriage or be related to sex. So obviously that's a reflection of both the marriages that she's been in.
Yeah. Can't be married and in love.
Yeah, because she and Henry had a lot of sex, but I don't think she considered them to be in love. Probably because there's no pining involved if you're married to someone. Like, if the ideal love is, like, this pining, unobtainable love, then, like, love for a husband or wife is, like, that's boring. Also, you'll love this. Eleanor's court held the notion, or it was, like, written in their laws that while women may be the property of men in all the realms outside of Aquitaine, within Elenor's realm, it was the other way around.
Yeah.
So that's matriarch talk. In the realm of love, women are in charge.
Yeah.
So Elenor used this court of love to promote ideas of chivalry and courtly love. Her court encouraged lively dancing and open flirtation, but not in a sort of bawdy, vulgar way. Everything was very infused with like wit and elegance and like, So this is where we're getting those like summer queen, like fairy queen vibes from Elenor. And in Aquitaine, and by extension, the whole Angevin Empire, Elenor finally found the respect, loyalty, and adoration that she'd been craving while queen in Paris. And she attracted renowned fighters to her cause, such as William Marshall, who began his very great military career in her service. The troubadour movement, of course, came into full swing. And generally, Elenor was the 12th century's biggest patron of art and literature, full stop. She's one of the big reasons that a cultural renaissance was even able to happen. Because, you know, the king wasn't doing it. The Norman poet Geoffrey of Monmouth wrote his Morte d'Arthur during Elenor's tenure, which is considered the most definitive source for the Arthurian legends.
Oh.
And Elenor was herself compared to Queen Guinevere.
Cool.
Quite a bit. Outside of culture, Elenor was also economically savvy. So she made lemons out of lemonade with the Second Crusade, and she brought back a lot of ideas about trade and shipping from the Eastern Mediterranean that then caught on in the Atlantic coast, where sea trade had been less of a thing. She fostered good diplomatic relationships outside of France. For example, at one point she goes to Spain to get her granddaughter, who will be very important, whose name is Blanche, introduces her to France, where she weds the French king, who was a future French king that we'll get into eventually. And Elenor didn't let the piety sides of things slide either. Of course, we've got her writing letters to the Pope. And while she looked really sacrilegious next to the overly pious Louis VII, she looked like a saint next to Henry II, who was, you know, going around accidentally murdering the Archbishop. And we see her church patronage increase steadily over time until finally, at the end of her life, she's very pious and she joins the church as a nun at Fontevraud. Yeah. So that's Voulez-Vous. It's pretty good. Yeah. Aquitaine was a pretty chill place to live under
Especially
Elenor. Especially as a woman. Outside of the civil wars, which are only like 4 or 5 years of her reign. So, not much. So what do we want to give for Voulez-Vous? I think for me it's got to be quite high. Like, very high. She's like the reason the 12th century Renaissance happens.
True.
So many poets, so many artists. We've seen, you know, I feel like this is the first time in a while we've seen like actual contemporary imagery.
I'm thinking nine
because
she loses a point for causing a bit of unrest when she was Queen of France. Like,
I agree. The Queen of France stuff is not great. It's just not really great as a people person.
Yeah.
But a lot of that is just her clashing with the culture. Not necessarily her.
True.
So I think it's 1 point off. I agree. So that's a 9 from both of us, which is an 18 for Voulez-Vous. What's 18 for Voulez-Vous? That's also equal to Charlemagne, who was the highest scorer in Voulez-Vous. He's still high scorer among the kings, but Elenor is now the highest scorer among the spectators. So let's move into Ooh La La.
Yes.
Ooh La La.
There's a lot to get into here. Villainous side of her reputation. She's accused of adultery multiple times, including with her uncle. She gets divorced. She gets imprisoned by her second husband.
The Rosamond myth.
Rosamond myth. The running off and getting married only just after her divorce, which, by the way, happened without the king's permission, which she was supposed to have gotten, which is why she married in secret. There's a lot of interesting, juicy bits in her life.
That very clearly biased favorites of children.
Yeah. Yeah, getting involved in causing a lot of the strife between her family.
Yeah, like between her own kids, like, you know.
Yeah.
I bet you all of them secretly hated Richard, or even openly did, because he was like...
Oh, definitely, definitely. Yeah, everyone hated Richard except Eleanor.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be high. It's not going to be Fredegund 10 levels because...
Yeah, I was thinking like 7 or 8.
There's no murder. Like, there's a lot of flirty, sexy stuff.
There's no, like, murder. And even, like, the Rosalind thing is just a myth.
There's no excommunication.
I know.
That's also a big thing that we look for.
I'm thinking 7.
I was thinking 7 as well, because that's, like, a middle-high, three-quarter situation for La. Okay. So that is a... Oh, perhaps. speaking of scandal. That is a 14 for Ulala.
Okay.
All right. Oh, this is very exciting. Mm-hmm. Now we get into Vee on Throne. We get into all of the children.
The Vee on Throne.
But are we doing the ones that survive her?
I'm going to go through all the children because it's important to learning about her legacy. But let's first focus on her reign. So Eleanor of Aquitaine, not Queen Regent of France. So we aren't basing Vee on Throne on a regency. And we are also not basing reigns on being consort. So we're basing her reign on the time she was Duchess of Aquitaine.
Yeah.
And she was Duchess from the 9th of April, 1137, assuming we count it from her father's death rather than when the news reached France, which was like 2 months later, to the 1st of April, 1204, when she died. That is 8 days short of 67 years.
Damn.
So 66 years, 11 months, and 23 days.
Only should live those 8 more days. It'd be so much rounder. Yeah.
Which is 12.5 points for the reign.
Not too shabby.
That's a longer reign than any king that we've talked about so far.
Mm.
Then onto the children. Eleanor of Aquitaine gave birth 10 times.
Mm-hmm. Damn.
And all but one lived to adulthood.
Yeah.
So she had 9 children lived to adulthood. Yet, even with 9 adult children, she ended up outliving most of them.
Yeah, obviously not John, but I don't know the other.
So let's start with children by Louis VII.
Okay.
So we've got Marie.
Yeah.
Who became Countess of Champagne by marrying Henry the Liberal of the House of Blois, who's the son of Tybalt the Great.
Okay.
Meanwhile, her younger sister, Alix, marries the younger brother of Henry the Liberal, of the House of Blois.
Okay.
So Alix becomes Countess of Blois by marrying Henry the Liberal's brother, Count Tybalt the Good. So we've got 2 brothers marrying 2 sisters. Sadly, however, both Marie and Alix died in the year 1198.
Oh, one after the other. Because she died, 12 before? So that's like, 6 years?
Well, Marie was 53 and Alix was 48 when they died. Yeah. So neither of them count, unfortunately.
Mm.
By Henry II, Eleanor proved that she was the most fertile of Myrtles, and she popped out babies throughout the 1150s and 1160s. So child number 3 is William, who was named Count of Poitou, but sadly died at the age of 3, so not counted. Then we get child number 4, Henry the Young King, or Henry the Absolute Worst, as I like to call him, who was just a spoiled brat. Who caused a lot of chaos and died in his 20s in 1183.
I guess at least he didn't live longer.
He actually was married to Louis VII's daughter by a subsequent marriage, Margaret of France. Yeah. So marrying his stepsister, casually, but they had no children.
Yeah. And
yes, so nothing comes of that. Then we've got Eleanor's 5th child, another daughter called Matilda, named after Empress Matilda. Who's grandma, who, like her namesake, was sent off to Germany to be married. So she became Duchess of Saxony and Bavaria by marrying Henry the Lion, and their son Otto the IV became Holy Roman Emperor. Matilda sadly died in her 30s, though. in 1189, shortly after her father, Henry II. So she's not counted. Then we move on to Eleanor's sixth child, who is Richard the Lionheart.
I know, he died before.
Yes. So after a youth spent training to be the next Duke of Aquitaine, he ended up succeeding his father as ruler of England, Normandy, and Anjou. He went off to a crusade, got imprisoned on the way back, got back, and then died in 1199, 5 years before his mother. So he's not counted. Okay. So child seven is Geoffrey, who became both Earl of Richmond in Northern England, but more importantly, Duke of Brittany through a mix of conquest, intrigue, and forcing the Duchess to marry him. Geoffrey will come up again in subsequent episodes because he is actually rather close to the French kings as a rival to Richard. But sadly for them, he fell off his horse and was trampled to death during a tournament in Paris.
So his horse.
Yes.
I say, ride donkeys. Never give someone being trampled to death by a donkey.
So that was that was in 1186 when he was age 28. Not counted.
Mm. We're dying in the 80s and 90s, it seems.
Yeah. It's all that neon in the 80s and 90s. Blinding them. They fall off their horses. So then we get to Eleanor's eighth child, who is named... Mm-hmm. It's Eleanor? A girl. Named Eleanor. Eleanor Jr. Who, taking a bit of a left turn, became Queen of Castile.
Ooh.
The largest Spanish kingdom.
Yeah.
Through marriage to King Alfonso VIII. Eleanor Jr. had a short-lived son named, what else but Henry I of Castile. And the crown passed to the eldest of her four daughters, Berengaria I. Who married her cousin, King Alfonso IX, and united the kingdoms of Castile and Leon. Yeah. So Eleanor Jr.'s other daughters also became queens as consorts. So Urraca was queen of Portugal. Eleanor, another Eleanor, was queen of Aragon. And Blanche became queen of France by marrying grandson of Louis VII. Grandma Eleanor of Aquitaine, at one point, as we've said, went to Castile to help negotiate that marriage. But back to Eleanor Jr., a Blanche of Castile's mother, she outlived her mother by 10 years.
Number one.
Making her, the first child that we can actually count towards the Beyond Throne score.
One.
So then we get to the ninth child, who's named Joan.
Joan, okay.
Not John yet. Joan. And she becomes Queen of Sicily by marrying William the Good, who is somehow related to Roger II, who hosted Eleanor on the Crusade. But she only ended up having children, Joan did, by her second husband, Count Raymond VI of Toulouse. So we're making peace with Toulouse, but having a marriage alliance with them. But again, Joan is not counted because she died during childbirth, just a few months after Richard the Lionheart. So her son was born by C-section after Joan died mid-labor.
And did the son survive or did it die the shortly after? The
son lived just long enough to be baptized Richard, but also died.
Oh.
Yeah. So then we've come to the final child, who was born when Eleanor was in her mid-40s.
Damn.
And that is John. And unfortunately for England, but very fortunately for France, John outlived his mother by 12 years and lost most of the Angevin Empire, but continued the Plantagenet line of English kings. So that's only two surviving children.
Damn, out of 10.
3.38 score. Yeah. But consolation for Eleanor was that at the time of her death in 1204, she had 19 living grandchildren across England, France, Spain, Germany, Italy.
Damn, so she was like Queen Victoria. Yeah,
and the Holy Land as well. Some of her children end up there. So
she was medieval Queen Victoria. Yeah.
And her daughter, Queen Eleanor of Castile, was pregnant with her 20th grandchild when she died. And her son, John, hadn't even had his 5 children yet when she died. So thanks to her long reign, though, she does make up those points. They're added to a total Beyond Throne score of 15.89.
Good job. Yeah,
it's actually just slightly higher than Louis VI from last episode. Who didn't reign as long but had more children. All right, so that's the points. Are we ready to tally up the final score?
Yes.
Are you ready for this? That is a score of 82.39.
Ooh.
That is...
Is she the highest?
2 whole points above Charlemagne.
Bam! Someone beat Charlemagne!
So, with that being said, you're so happy. Yeah.
I'm just happy someone finally beat Charlemagne. Like, I know it's not, she's not in the actual, like, tournament, but still.
You're as happy as Eleanor learning that Henry II died and getting freed from prison. Yeah.
I never thought anyone would beat Charlemagne.
Eleanor of Aquitaine has beaten Charlemagne.
But she has. Woo! And it's a woman.
Officially better than Charlemagne, and she's a woman. So.
Yes. We've said that. So
we've definitively decided that. Nearly 3 hours later. So, with that said, she's in the VIP box, I guess. Yeah. Like, there's no.
We don't even need to ask a question. We already know.
No, I'm writing down VIP box now. So she is there.
Yeah. I'm surprised you didn't even pre-put it in.
She is ensconced with Fredegund and Charles Martel in the VIP box.
I can imagine her somehow like really bonding with Fredegund.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, they're both women, they're like, yeah, in power, like, you know.
But Fredegund's wearing these like drab Dark Ages clothing. And then Eleanor comes in and she's like, have you tried silk? And then like Fredegund just Fredegund's like, no!
I imagine Fredegund though, like in like dark red vibes.
Yeah.
Right? Blood red. And then like...
And then Eleanor comes in and
she's like light blue. Yeah, like, you know, very... Have you thought... And then Eleanor's like, have you thought of maybe like a green? And Fredegund's like, And then Fredegund's like, have you thought of having more daggers?
Yeah. Also, they're like being really nice to each other, but they're constantly trying to poison each other.
Or they're constantly comparing each other. Against each other, like making like, you know, slight digs, being like, oh yeah, but I have this many kids, and oh yeah, but I poisoned someone, I went on a crusade.
I was like, sorry, but I got 30 more points than you in the overall score, so.
And Fredegund's like, yeah, but were you really a scandalous? Where's your murder?
Eleanor's like, a 10 for Enchanté, that's cute, I have 20.
And then Fredegund's like, yeah, at least I didn't get in prison for 16 years.
At least I didn't have to take sanctuary in a church with my baby son. Anyway, we could go on.
I know.
But
be such a great combo.
Let's not have the women fighting. Let's have the women getting along.
Oh, no, I'm saying like they get along, but they're silently being like, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's snide remarks, but it never escalates into.
Yeah, but they like still get along. And Martel's just like in the background being like, don't forget about me. I'm also with you guys. And they're like, you're a man, get lost.
Charles Martel is just very intimidated at this point.
Yeah, literally. They just both like stare daggers. Like that's what mutually bonds them, is that they're just like men.
Yeah. They're just like, daggers to Charles Martel. I do think by the end of the series, the VIP box is just going to be like all women and Charles Martel.
Yes. Yes, probably.
But we'll see. We'll see if there's any other dudes that get in there.
He's like, I'm outnumbered.
He's very outnumbered. He's already outnumbered. There's only three.
I know.
All right. So that is Eleanor of Aquitaine. Let us know what you thought of our scores. I haven't listened to what Rex Factor's scores were since that episode aired, so I had no idea how different our scores are. I'm assuming we were more generous because we just have had a lot of pathetic rulers. But we'll see.
Yeah, so we love a strong female too, so. And they've done so many females.
That's true.
Strong females by now, so they could be a bit harsher while us were like, oh, this is a rare one.
Yeah, exactly. Where we've been starving for this. So... Yeah. Congratulations, Eleanor of Aquitaine, who is, if you count everybody that we rated, the top scorer.
Yeah.
Sadly, she's not competing in the tournament because it would just be unfair to everyone else.
Yeah.
And she gets to sip wine with Fredegund, watch and relax.
Yeah.
So join us next time when we review her husband, Louis VII, who will be a more interesting one, I think, to review because... It's a much more murky, complicated story with him. I think he's in many ways misunderstood.
Well, he's so overshadowed.
So overshadowed. But he definitely won't get 82.
Yeah.
I can say that now. All right, so that is going to be a goodbye from me.
Goodbye from me.
We did it. We made it.